Section 8, the disease of asceticism. If you are unable to arouse the doubt when practicing Zen, you may become obsessed with a goal, preoccupied with achieving liberation, even undergo ascetic extremes. Not seeking warmth in winter or shade in summer. If asked for the shirt off your back, you give away your whole wardrobe. Content freezing to death, you assume it to be liberation. If asked for food, you go without eating. Content starving to death, you assume it to be liberation. It takes many forms, but generally speaking, comes from a laudable intention. That is a good, worthy intention. The problem is that it ends up deceiving the unwitting who take the ascetic for a living Buddha or Bodhisattva and give all they can as offerings. People don't realize that this is abusing the Buddhist precepts and that all such acts are harmful. Others burn part of their bodies as sacrificial offerings, constantly worship the Buddha, and confess their faults. From the worldly viewpoint, this is certainly virtuous. As far as true religious inquiry goes, however, it is quite meaningless. As it has been said since of old, never get attached to Dharma expressions. Worshipping the Buddha is one such Dharma expression, as is confession. All good things of the Buddha Dharma are so. I am not saying to dispense with them, but to do them with the right mind, thus to nourish the roots of all that is good. When your Dharma eye opens, you will see. Sweeping away the burnt incense offerings is itself Buddha Dharma at work. A different tone here because he's speaking to the person who may be killing himself in his practice, quite literally. Once again, when necessary, commenting. If you're unable to arouse the doubt when practicing Zen, you may become obsessed with a goal, preoccupied with achieving liberation, even undergo ascetic extremes. You see how, despite appearances to the contrary, he is undercutting all three of those, not only ascetic practice, but to be obsessed with some kind of a goal. Satori. Enlightenment, preoccupied with achieving liberation. He does not allow room even for that. Indeed. Continuing, not seeking warmth in winter or shade in summer. If asked for the shirt off your back, you give away your whole wardrobe. Selfless giving, is it not? One of the paramitas, is it not? Content freezing to death, you assume it to be liberation. If asked for food, you go without eating. Content starving to death, you assume it to be liberation. It takes many forms, but generally speaking, comes from a laudable, a good intention. The problem is that it ends up deceiving the unwitting who take the ascetic for a living Buddha or Bodhisattva and give all they can as offerings. People don't realize that this is abusing the Buddhist precepts and that all such acts are harmful. As you may know, it is quite common in these Buddhist countries when a Buddhist monk or a nun shows some sign of wisdom or power, often actually kind of miraculous powers. It's not uncommon. The faithful, I have freely translated it as the unwitting, in the sense that they may not know any better. They may be farmers or fishermen living in villages, not for the most part with much money themselves, living, eking out a difficult living with family, with children, relatives to care for, dependent upon weather and other conditions. And yet, in their simple, faithful hearts, they see the power and the authority of this monk or nun, and so they gather together and they give everything they can. Sometimes maybe even taking away the food from their hungry child, because this is a living Buddha, this is a bodhisattva, we must make an offering. It's a bit, a different kind of thinking than we have here in the West, but of making offerings to someone who has apparently achieved liberation. Well, he's criticizing this and saying if it's not really genuine, it does harm on both sides, right? Both for the person making the offering and for the person receiving it. He concludes that paragraph with all such acts are harmful. Continuing, others burn part of their bodies as sacrificial offerings, constantly worship the Buddha and confess their faults. You may not be so familiar with this, having read these high-level, perhaps rather abstract Zen books, but for the average Buddhist believer, or for someone being ordained as a monk or a nun, it is not uncommon to burn a part of their fingers or a place on their head or their forehead. There are many different rituals like this, as a kind of a symbol of becoming ordained, entering the priesthood, and things like this. Also, of course, worshipping the Buddha, a formal figure or statue of the Buddha representing that, confessing their faults once or twice a month, this is a common practice. Poshan continues, from the worldly viewpoint, this is certainly virtuous. As far as true religious inquiry goes, however, it is quite meaningless. As it has been said since of old, never get attached to Dharma expressions. This quote is difficult to accurately translate, but very simply what it means is there are countless expressions of the Dharma. But if we mistake the concrete expression for the boundless Dharma itself, you see what happens, right? Then, well, we imitate the act, and then we're Zen, right? Or we mouth these words, and then it's Zen, right? So it's a very general expression. Again, talking about any Dharma expression, an act, a thought, a word, mistaking that particular form for the boundless Dharma. So once again, something like never get attached to the Dharma expression. The simple example used in Buddhism to illustrate this is the flower and the smile. What was originally the so-called first transmission of Zen, right? Gautama Buddha at one point raising a flower. And everyone in the audience, nice flower, now give us your enlightening words. They're waiting, but the one person in the audience, according to the legend, huh, that really grasped the true import. Everything has already been said. Mahakashyapa, who became the first patriarch of the Zen tradition, smiles. Just, it came, where did it come from? The universe itself, from the flower? Anyway, Gautama Buddha raises the flower without uttering a word. The whole audience rapt attention. Come on. But Mahakashyapa can't help it. And then, of course, the famous words, Gautama Buddha transmitting the untransmittable, transmitting the Dharma, and saying, in effect, you the man. So again, this is an example of what is called the Dharma expression. What at that point was living, dynamic, in a sense, the full expression of the Buddha Dharma right there and then. The flower, raising the flower, or Mahakashyapa smiling. Both are full and complete expressions of the Buddha Dharma. But when people start imitating it, right? They're mistaking the formal expression for the living fact, you see? So again, that's what is behind this quote. And you see a lot of what Poshan is criticizing is precisely that, in word, in deed, right? Once again, never get attached to Dharma expressions. Poshan explains, worshipping the Buddha is one such Dharma expression, as is confession. All good things of the Buddha Dharma are so. I am not saying to dispense with them. Certainly at that time there were people who were saying that, right? Right? You don't need any of that stuff. Just do what you like. I am not saying to dispense with them, but to do them with the right mind, thus to nourish the roots of all that is good. When your Dharma eye opens, you will see. Then he gives the example, sweeping away the burnt incense offerings is itself Buddha Dharma at work. I put in brackets, an act as simple and natural as sweeping away the burnt. In other words, that itself becomes not some highfalutin lifting the flower or smiling or kicking or shouting. Sweeping away the incense offerings. That'll do. Again, the point of this section 8 is what could be called asceticism. And during a retreat, for sure, to some extent, it's quite appropriate. We are giving up a lot of our human comforts engaging in this retreat. But please don't mistake it for the way. There's always the danger of these original and spontaneous Dharma acts, statements, expressions, in response to the particular situation at the time, degenerating into patterned forms that are imitated. One of my first teachers used to say, the ego self can corrupt anything it comes into contact with. That includes Zazen itself. Beware. Of course, it's no better to prematurely abandon such Dharma acts, thinking, well, anything goes, I can just indulge as I please. That's no better. You remember in the very beginning the lecture I gave, those three examples. The one was the peach blossoms. Ever since seeing the peach blossoms, I have never doubted. Huh? Perhaps this is a good time to open up. You've probably all in one context or another heard that story. But just to put it in the present context. Huh? Again, if you will allow me to quote some words. Lingyun, in Japanese, Reiyun, actually, this is the name Reiyun Inn, the first temple that I lived in where Yamada Mumon Roshi was in retirement at the time, one of the sub-temples of Myoshinji is called Reiyun Inn. It's from this monk's name, his name as a monk, Reiyun. Literally something like spiritual cloud, Reiyun. But it was the name of this monk. And the story is so famous that I think the second day, the day after I arrived in Japan in 1981, I mentioned Saturday night that the guy sitting right there who was just there for the lecture, he's the guy that picked me up at the airport and took me, and I spent the first night at his home. He was living in Funokayama, the northern part of Kyoto, practicing at Daitokuji, was Kobori Nande at the time. He was there with his wife who was studying tea at Reiyun Inn. I hadn't moved in yet. I had just arrived the next day, and he took me. I met Chi-san, Priscilla then. She was there, talking about, I think I'm going home. I've been here for, she's still there, by the way. I think I'm going home. But the name of this monthly gathering where Yamada Mumon, quite old at this time, he was, I think at that time, still the head abbot of Myoshinji. Maybe he had just retired as the president of Hanazono. But they called those monthly meetings the Plum Blossom Meeting, because of this connection with Reiyu, this master. Very simply, the story is Lingyun, or in Japanese, Reiyun, was enlightened, it was said, upon seeing the blossoms of a peach tree. So very early spring, probably just about now in this part of China. Even before the sakura, the cherry, and the peach. And then he wrote, as is common, to write an enlightenment verse, an expression of what he came to. And he wrote, "For decades I sought a sword master," literally a sword master, a master of the dan. He's not talking about a teacher out there. He's talking about the true master. "For decades I sought a sword master. How many times have leaves fallen and new buds appeared? How many years have I struggled on and on, pushing, pushing?" I wonder how many retreats he did, huh? "But," and then the quote, "but since seeing the peach blossoms, I have never doubted again." One of the reasons it's such a marvelous expression is that it clearly shows both his tremendous determination and his commitment. He wasn't looking at flowers in bloom for a long, long time. He was just throwing himself into the practice. And yet, oddly enough, perhaps not so oddly, one day out on his rounds in the mountains, just about this time of year, he happened to look up from out of the depths of that, and something so delicate, huh? So delicate, just a little blossom, peach blossom. And his 20, 30 years of practice fell away like that, cut through by a peach blossom. So the marvelous subtlety of this just a little peach blossom. That happened to be what did it. A famous comment on this poem of Reyun is the following. Peach blossoms all fallen away. Where now shall I meet Reyun? You see, this expression is to keep the person from getting attached to the expression. Of course, now you can get attached to that one too. It's something that must be done with care. But do you see what the comment is saying? Great, great, but the peach blossoms are falling away. They're gone. Now, how will you meet Reyun if it's really alive? If you're looking for it in the peach blossoms, you're already gone. Once again, that is a bit of the background of one of those three quotes that I gave in the very beginning, Saturday evening. You see how it is intimately connected with our present theme. I love being proved wrong. Don't you? You see, what Po Shan is saying is true, even of our hallowed great doubt as well. Great doubt, gone awry, gone wrong, turns into some self-preoccupied, mental masturbation in the name of great doubt. Bankei nails it down very clearly here. What he says is the following. What's worse, he has spoken in the previous paragraph of what he calls eyeless priests. What's worse, they tell practicers that unless they can raise a great doubt block and then break through it, there can't be any progress in Zen. Instead of teaching them to live by the unborn Buddha mind, he's a little weak here. He shouldn't say that. He should say, instead of living by the unborn Buddha mind, they start by forcing them to raise this doubt block any way they can. People who don't have a doubt are now saddled with one. Norman Waddell's wonderful translation. They've turned their Buddha minds into blocks of doubt. It's absolutely wrong. Bankei is absolutely right. That is not what Po Shan means by the great doubt. That is, as Bankei said, he mentioned Saturday, an imitation of a doubt. And so, the day never comes when we find a real resolution. Look under your own feet. Don't waste time trying to arouse something that is not there. Are there any questions about section 8, the disease of asceticism? I think we're ready for a 10-minute break and then come back at 10:30 to sit. Thank you for listening so intently.